Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Kevin Moore Show. I'm Kevin Moore, and it is a pleasure to be spending the next hour with you. Our opening musical selection was Promises, Promises, a wonderful song from the great composer Burt Bacharach. And that's what I have for all of you today, the promise that this next hour will be informative, interesting, provocative, and maybe even a little exciting. A promise that our discussions will give you something to think about today and hopefully something to talk about tomorrow. Or what I'd like to think of as a civilized hour of culture and conversation. Well, as I like to do to begin each of our shows, I like to read or share a recent poignant story or an especially interesting essay or some philosophical quotes or thoughts or sometimes even a little poetry that touches or speaks to us all. Well, we have Easter coming up, so I thought we'd read a little editorial by the very talented Jack Spadafora. Entitled Green Pastures, He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. Have you been searching for that place too, especially at this holy time of year? That metaphorical place where, in the middle of another crushing day, you can find a safe and silent sanctum? Somewhere you might get off the careening carousel just long enough to catch your breath, your sanity, your souls. Oh, it's there. Only you may be looking for it in the wrong way. As you've suspected by now, it's not really a place, but rather a state of mind, a sliver of time in the great continuum, which, like some fragile mountain crevice, briefly offers your ascent a more secure footing. If you can spot it, if you can reach it, if you can somehow wrap what's left of your courage around it, then maybe you can get through the rest of this day. Shamans conjure it. Mystics think it. Saints pray it. You and I, well, the best we mere mortals can do is maybe believe it. We believe there are such green pastures along this climb, which starts the moment the surgeon slaps our little soft buttock, compelling us to begin it with no mistake. But remember, climb starts as a yelp for life and will now persist until a final sigh for peace. For us, the children of Eve, there is no other way. However, if life is a struggle, climbers throughout history have had their say as to what it all means. Priests and priestesses, theologians and philosophers, poets and warriors have each in their time shouted down from their climb what it means. This leaves each of us to believe and follow as we see fit. Of all the options we've heard, the vision of those quiet green pastures seems the most enduring. I, for one, know they exist. I've walked them, but only briefly. Only temporarily, only in those rare instances when they smell so green and fragrant and safe, then, all too quickly, disappear before my eyes. All I can do, like you, is keep trying to find them again. Easter and Passover are certainly a good time to try. From Jack Spadafora, green pastures, they're out there. What did old Mr. Reynolds say? Life is just one crisis after another, and if you have a little peace, enjoy it because it won't last. God bless him, but it might be true. So I'll add all I need to know about life I learned from the Easter Bunny. Don't put all of your eggs in one basket. Walk softly and carry a big carrot. Everyone needs a friend who is all ears. There's no such thing as too much candy. A cute little tale attracts a lot of attention. Everyone is entitled to a bad hair day. Some body parts should be floppy. Good things come in small, sugar-coated packages. An Easter bonnet can tame even the wildest hair. To show your true colors, you have to come out of your shell. The best things in life are still sweet and gooey. And let happy thoughts multiply like rabbits. So some of the things we learned from the Easter Bunny. One of the fun things about hosting my radio show is having the opportunity of making the acquaintance of some very interesting, talented, and fascinating people. And our first very special guest is just such a person. She's a woman who's spoken to us through her words and imagination and ideas for these last few years. Yet the work she has done has stimulated and engaged a reader's intellect and our own imagination through her creativity and style. Each of M.J. Rose's best-selling novels revolves around an enthralling secret, a secret trapped in time, a secret people would kill for. Her reincarnation novels, which include The Book of Lost Fragrances and Seduction, are a heady combination of historical fiction, paranormal intrigue, and ancient cultures encased in page-turning, time-slip novels of suspense. Both were named Indie Next Picks, garnered starred trade reviews, and received high praise from the likes of People, The New York Times, and USA Today. Rose won the 2013 Crimson Scribe Award for Seduction, which Suspense Magazine presents yearly to one author to honor the best book of the year. She has been profiled in Time Magazine, Forbes, The New York Times, Business 2.0, Working Woman, Newsweek, and New York Magazine. From one of America's most imaginative storytellers comes a passionate tale of love and treachery, spanning the days of Catherine de' Medici's court to the 21st century and starring a woman drawn back, time and again, to the past. MJ Rose is the international best-selling author of 14 novels and 2 nonfiction books. She is a founding board member of International Thriller Writers and founded the first marketing company for authors, AuthorBuzz.com. A woman whose distinctive literary virtuosity not only sets the standard, but also defines the essence of excellence in the world of mysteries and thrillers, presenting her newest book, The Collector of Dying Breaths. It's a pleasure to introduce MJ Rose. MJ, welcome to the Kevin Moore Show.
Oh, thank you for the lovely introduction.
Well, you're very welcome. I love the book.
Thank you.
If I was going to go into Barnes & Noble, would I look under fiction or autobiography?
Definitely fiction.
Oh, good. So if we talk about the steamy parts, then we won't be embarrassing each other here. That's terrific. A great book, you know, very exciting. If it wasn't for Dan Brown, would MJ Rose be writing the historical thrillers like this?
Definitely, because I was inspired by books that came way before Dan Brown.
You were? Which books?
Yeah, well, H. Rider Haggard wrote a book called She. He also wrote King Solomon's Mind in the late 1800s.
Okay.
And then Catherine Neville wrote a book called The Eight in the 1980s. And then she went on to write a couple of other books. And I was much more, I actually didn't read Dan Brown when everybody else was reading Dan Brown.
Really?
Yeah. I was much more inspired by those historical fiction books because it's historical fiction that gets me excited, not so much what kind of book I'm writing. I've written, you know, a lot of different kind of books. They're not all this. They're not all like this. I have a whole series of books about a New York City sex therapist. So Dan Brown certainly doesn't write about that. Sex is not part of Dan Brown's world. I don't know how people get there. I don't think they even kiss.
I like historical thrillers. I think they should have a section in the bookstores just for historical thrillers, especially writers like yourself who research diligently and provide very provocative and truthful information. And sometimes that doesn't always happen, MJ.
No, and it's hard to find that provocative information that's actually based on truth. I'm actually going through it right now where I'm really looking for something for the next book and having trouble finding something in history that fits. So it doesn't always work.
Now, this, of course, takes place in France, and the characters have kind of a counterpart from the Renaissance and a counterpart to, you know, modern day. Now, you have Jack, who is Isabeau. You have Griffin, who is...
Don't give it all away.
Well, I want to make sure I got my mind right. Who's like Renee... and then I was doing some research on Catherine de' Medici, and she was a great collector of things also, much like Melano.
So I don't really make the decision about whether the people in the book are each other reincarnated.
Okay.
Except for one person.
Okay.
I guess in this book there are two. There are two people that my main character at the end of the book believes that she and a man that she's been in love with for a while were probably the 16th century perfumer and his lover. Whether Catherine de' Medici, whether Melinoway is reincarnated as Catherine de' Medici, I kind of wanted to leave up to the reader. It certainly was a possibility, but I didn't want to push it because Catherine de' Medici... one of the things I don't like about discussing reincarnation with people is that people always say, oh, yeah, I was Cleopatra. I was Napoleon, you know. So there's Melinoway. Oh, yeah, she was Catherine de' Medici. So I really wanted to leave that one alone because most people are not, you know, somebody famous.
I was taught by Dominican nuns and Jesuit priests, so they always thought I was a hoodlum in my other life. So something to do with it.
Except they don't believe in reincarnation.
Well, you know, this is interesting here about Catherine de Medici, where you take that as a basic historical fact and kind of build upon that. What came first, the idea about the perfume, or the idea about how do you tie Catherine de Medici into this time frame situation, and then you have the present time?
So I write, the way that I write is kind of like I have a stove with a whole lot of pots of soup on the stove.
Okay.
And as I read and research different things pop out at me, and I put them into different pots on the stove. So there were three separate things that I read that wound up on the stove. One was I read that Henry Ford, the auto magnet and creator of the Model T, and Thomas Alva Edison, obviously the creator of the light bulb and many other things, both believed in reincarnation, and both believed that when you died, your soul left your body in your dying breath. And that if you could capture that dying breath, they believed you could reincarnate the person whose breath you had.
Okay.
And they believed it so strongly that Thomas Alva Edison had his last breath collected in a test tube in a museum, which was his house. So that piece of information went into one pot. I was like obsessed with this idea. I couldn't believe it. Then I was reading something else about perfume, because I've been writing a lot about perfume, and I discovered that Catherine de Medici was really the person who brought perfume to France in the 1530s, that France really didn't have a perfume industry until she brought her perfumer from Italy with her when she was 14 years old and came to France to marry the prince.
Right.
So that went in one pot. And those were really the two separate things that kind of simmered separately, and then I kind of thought, well, what if I really wanted to write about Catherine de Medici's perfumer, because it seemed like such an interesting side note to history, is a man who spent his life with a queen who had him making perfume and poison for her, because actually poison's always been a woman's weapon of choice.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more feminine and ladylike than a gun or knives, easier, messier. It's sly and it's seductive. You slip it into a glass. It's harder to detect than anything. And she had her perfumer creating these poisons, and René was very creative, and he created poisons like he poisoned gloves. So if you wore them for 3 days, they seeped into your skin and you died, or shirts that when you wore them for a couple of days, the chemicals would get into your skin and died. So those things just all coalesced. So nothing really came first. It just all simmered together.
Which was kind of sad the way the gloves turned out at the end. People will be able to see that when they read the book.
No, don't say. You're giving it away.
Well, I'm just enticing everybody to read it. Catherine was 14 when she married Henry, of course, and for the first 10 years of their lives, weren't able to have children, then all of a sudden blossomed and had 10 or 8 or 10 more.
Yeah, he had surgery. There was something wrong with him, they finally found out.
Oh, that's what it was. That was a change.
He had surgery, and then he was okay.
And his mistress was Diane de Poitiers, who was twice his age.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Memory and scent are themes in your books. You had a background in the perfume industry. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, when I was in the advertising business, I was the creative director of large agency in New York City, and one of my accounts was Charles of the Rift fragrance. They made opium perfume and other Yves Saint Laurent fragrances. They made Paris, and I got involved in a launch of a brand new perfume with them where we got to work with Charles of the Rift from the inception and the creation of the scent itself through the bottle, through naming, through doing the commercials, all the way up to seeing the commercials on the Oscars the year that the perfume launched. And so I really fell in love with everything about perfume from that two-year process. And it never really left me. And I was really happy to be able to return to it a couple of years ago when I came up with the idea of this character whose background was an old French perfume company that was still in existence since before Napoleon's time.
And the way René puts together the scents and the perfumes and so forth. Is that how it's really made with all the different, the way he just kind of...
Yeah, so René LaFlorentine is the French perfumer, and he's making perfume from the time. He's an orphan in Italy and is apprenticed to the monk who makes scented waters, and he learns from him. And everything that he learns and everything that I discussed about the processes of perfume in the book are all true. I don't make up anything. All those ingredients, by the way, I should tell people who haven't read the book, there are some very strange ingredients that perfumers use that a lot of people can't quite believe when I tell them. And one of the strange things about, I'll tell you what some of them are, but one of the strange things about that I like to think about it before I say this is, think about the first person who found the thing I'm about to say and decided, yes, I'm going to mix that into a perfume and see if it makes it smell better.
Mm-hmm.
So here are some of the two oddest things. There's ambergris, which is whale vomit. The way whales' digestive systems work, they vomit up this gray matter, and it kind of cures in the salt water and then on the beach in the sun, and it ages. And it's this hard substance that looks like a rock. And it's worth more than gold. Literally, it's worth more than gold.
Really?
By the ounce. And people literally have, since time immemorial, have shaved off pieces of that and diluted it and used it in perfume. So, like, who thought of using whale vomit in perfume?
Wow.
And the next one is momi, which is, a black sticky substance that comes out of the skull of embalmed corpses who are mummified. And people went into crypts and they scraped off this black sticky substance from the skulls of the corpses who had been mummified, and they used this black sticky substance in perfume. Now, who ever said, gee, yeah, I'm going to take mummy scrap and use it in perfume? It's like, what? Huh?
How do you trace that back, that somebody would figure that out, though? Who's the first guy did this?
But the most I could get to is ancient books in Latin that describe the ingredients and describe how to use them. And I found a 15th century one that describes, like, it has to be shiny and black, and if it's gray, then it's not the right consistency, and don't use it if it's gray, only use it when it's shiny. I mean, there's a whole, it's a whole alchemical, amazing world back then.
And people still collect ambergris?
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's no longer used in perfume, partially because it's so expensive and it's a little allergenic, they think.
Mm-hmm.
So they've kind of outlawed it, but niche perfumers who don't sell things for a long period of time. I mean, who don't sell things on the open market. I mean, they do, but I mean, they don't sell in department stores. They're not governed by the same rules. They sell out of their ateliers. They still often use ambergris.
Oh, it must be a little, because the whales cough it up, so that is kind of a... Scent is a powerful memory trigger, of course. The memory center of the brain sits next to the olfactory center of the brain. How many people in our lives have we kind of identified with their, would you say, scent or their aroma or the way they smell or the perfumes they use? I mean, we do that every day.
Right, and that's why sometimes you'll just, like, be in an elevator and without even knowing why, you'll turn around and look for your high school girlfriend.
And or... I came from an Italian family. My mother's Italian. My father's Irish. The smell of a house and food and so forth, you identify with that. And that triggers your memory, too, to some pleasant times, of course, in the past. And not dissimilar to what Jack is experiencing in the book.
Right, right. Jacques is a particularly sensitive nose, just because, that's who she is. And she's very sensitive to scent, but you would be if you grew up in a family of perfumers.
Your first Jacques Lattois novel inspired a perfume, Âme Sœur, The Scent of Soulmates by Joya Studios. How did this partnership come to be?
Oh, that's amazing. And it's still for sale, and it's still Jacques' perfume. So what happened was, when I started the first book, The Book of Lost Fragrances, in the series, I found it incredibly difficult to write about perfume and write about scent. I mean, I write about the senses all the time, and I use all the different, or six senses, a lot in my fiction. But writing a whole book that had so much to do with perfume was really trying my creative ability. So I went to the store, and I bought a lot of different scented candles.
Mm-hmm.
And I started burning the candles while I was writing. And there was one particular candle that was more pleasing, but also more inspiring to me. I always felt better able to write when I was smelling that particular candle. So when I was done with the book and I got the advance reading copies, I sent one. I found out who created that candle, and I sent him a book. I didn't know him. I sent him a book, and I thanked him for the candles, and I told him the mm-hmm. story that I had written this book basically smelling his candles. And he read the book, and he contacted me, and we met for coffee. And while we were meeting for coffee, I mentioned that I had really wanted to create a perfume for the book, but I had looked into it, and it was so expensive. And he said, well, you know, it's funny, because I was thinking I would really like to create a perfume for the book. I would like to create the scent that you talk about in the book and my version of it. And I was, like, beyond happy. And so he let me name it. He actually, when he told me that I could name it, I actually started to cry.
Oh, that's cool.
I didn't believe I was going to get to name a perfume. So I named it the same name as the perfume in the book, which is one of Jacques' favorite scents. It's called Amsour, AmesSoeurs, and it's French for soulmate. And it's called, on the bottle it says Amsour, the scent of soulmates. And it's for sale online at netaporte.com and joyousstudios.com. And it's on sale at Fred Siegel stores on the West Coast and Henri Bendel in New York. So it's out there. It's for sale. Jacques' perfume is being worn by women everywhere.
That's interesting. That's right. Art imitates life and vice versa.
Yeah.
During the Renaissance, when you talk about scented candles, did they have scented candles then? Did perfumers make scented candles then?
Well, you know, candles smelled then because of the way that wax was collected and the way wax was made.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, Napoleon, who was incredibly sensitive to smell, could only have candles made from one particular kind of beeswax because the smell was less obnoxious to him.
Hmm.
He went through 2 quarts of cologne in a week.
Because,
you know, one thing people don't think about is that Europe really smelled bad.
Well, you didn't shower a lot then either.
Yeah. He took 2 baths, one when they were born and one when they died, and some people, if they were rich enough, one on their wedding night or the night before they got married. And people really smelled terrible, and so scented water and perfume for the upper classes was the way that they disguised their body odor.
Hmm.
And it really smelled bad. I mean, there are stories of in the palaces, there would be, you know, people that had to go to the bathroom that would go on the staircase.
Hmm.
I mean, our concepts of cleanliness just have nothing to do with their concepts of cleanliness.
I wonder why that was. They had tubs. I'm sure they had bathtubs. People bathed,
They had tubs that they poured water into. But what people, you know, in ancient times, people were very clean. Egyptians were fanatically clean. Ancient Romans had baths, and they
mm-hmm.
were fanatically clean. But in the Middle Ages, because of diseases, because as cities, okay, so cities grew up in Europe and were very crowded, and people were living in crowded quarters and going to the bathroom in the same places that they were washing, and they were getting sick,
mm.
and people didn't really know how to connect the fact that water was making them sick. It was, but it was making them sick because they were defecating and urinating into the water.
Yeah.
So if they had been able to figure out, which they finally did, but it took till, you know, the 1700s to figure this out, that they finally, or I guess the early 1800s, they finally figured out that if you kept the water clean, the water was good for you, not bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
But for all those 300 years, they believed that the water was bad for you. So they were scared of the water, scared of taking too many baths. They thought that you got sick from the bath.
Hmm. Interesting. Besides being an international best-selling author, you're also recognized as a pioneer in the publishing world. Now, how did that come about, MJ?
It's totally by accident, you know. Like everything that's interesting happens to people.
Just pots on the stove, right?
I had an agent, and I had written 2 novels, and she hadn't been able to sell them because everybody said that my books crossed too many genres.
Mm-hmm.
They were a little bit of a mystery. They were a little bit erotic. They were a little bit, they were commercial fiction, but they were literary fiction. Nobody knew what to call them. And so the publishers were rejecting them, saying that they really liked the writing style, but that I really needed to hone in on do one kind of book. And none of it made sense to me because I grew up reading really wildly. And to me, there were either good books or bad books. There weren't, like, you know, these specific tiny little categories. Both books got rejected, and she said, well, why don't you try to write a third book that's a little bit more specific, because now we've had this happen on two books. And I was like, I sat down and I started, and I, you know what, that's what I write. I write books that aren't one clear cut, mm-hmm. one kind of story. They're complex stories.
Sure.
And so I decided, I was in advertising, I decided that if the marketing was the problem, I would take my book and I would create a facsimile of it, and I would sell it online. This was 1998 when nobody was doing this.
Mm-hmm.
I would sell it online using different ad campaigns and see which ad campaign worked. Not sell the book, not like sell thousands of copies, like maybe sell 100 copies using three different campaigns and see which one worked better. And then I would give the agent back the campaign, and I'd say, here, go back to the publisher and say, this is how you sell this kind of book. Because I was in advertising. I advertised everything from McDonald's hamburgers to Maidenform bras. I knew how to do ads.
Mm-hmm.
So I did this. I printed up some copies of the book, and I made an electronic download of the book, and I went online. I built a little website, and I started advertising the book, and the book started selling. Well, the books kind of started selling despite me, or because of all everything I was doing, much more than I expected it to sell. And it got really... It sold like almost 3,000 copies, and the Doubleday Book Club and Literary Guild discovered it online at Amazon, which was the only place I could sell it, because they were totally open to any publisher. And they contacted me and said they wanted to publish this book. They thought I was the publisher. Well, I was also the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, it's self-published, and I had an editor edit it, but they said, we don't care. It's a terrific book. And I said, well, have you ever bought a self-published book before? Because I'd taken a lot of grief. I mean, my agent left me because she said only people who can't get published self-publish.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, yeah, I can't get published. She said, you should just keep writing a book until you get published. I mean, she's just like, you have to do it the traditional way. And I was like, I don't understand the word no. The more she said don't do it, the more I wanted to do it. So I called, once the Doubleday Book Club and Literary Guild made the deal with me, I called AP and Bloomberg and all the wire services and told them that the first book that had been self-published had just been picked up by New York Publishing.
Mm-hmm.
And it got taken by the wire services, and I was in Time and Newsweek and all those things you mentioned as the first person to use the Internet to get a book published.
Oh. A labyrinthine journey, but kind of certainly worthwhile. You're a founding member of the International Thriller Writers and co-president with Lee Child. I enjoy his books, Jack Reacher novels and so forth, always exciting. And I think Steve Barry, who we've had as a guest on our show many times, is also part of that. Tell us a little about that group.
Yeah, we started in 2004 as a way to really celebrate this smaller genre, which actually sells more books, but there's the whole mystery genre, and within the mystery genre, there are different kinds of books. And the traditional mystery is whodunit, you know, Agatha Christie,
sure.
whodunit. But what thrillers are really is howdunit. You know, you often know in a thriller who did the crime or who's going to do the crime, and you're following them to see if it really happens, or you're following to see that another one doesn't happen. But the mystery of a thriller isn't who did it necessarily. And because they were so different, as thriller writers, we didn't usually wind up getting included in a lot of things that more traditional mystery authors were included in. And we were like the stepchildren of the industry. So a bunch of us decided that there was room for a new writers organization, and it would have different goals, and the main goal would be to celebrate the thriller form and to help the authors get attention, which is a very different goal from other writers' organizations. Yes, it's a support group, but it's also a very active organization that tries to get attention from readers for its authors. And that made us very different from everybody else. And why I was, you know, really excited to be part of it, Lee and I both felt when we were part of the original group, we really felt that was one of the most important things that we could do. Is create an organization that basically helped market books, which is kind of natural to both of us. Lee comes from a TV background, and I come from an advertising background.
Is there a website for the International Thriller Writers?
Yes, it's thrillerwriters. I always get this wrong, but just Google International Thriller Writers, and we have an incredible event in New York with over 50 to 100 giant best-selling authors who all come and mix and mingle with friends and fans and readers, and it's great for anybody who wants to come to New York for a little vacation.
You know, we have something in Chicago here. I was going to mention it to Deb Ziff. Maybe she already knows it. It's called the Chicago Tribune Literary Festival and Book Fair, which comes around every year around beginning of June. That might be something that should be looked into, because I'm sure people would love to have you out here. You know, you get to meet the authors, you give a little introduction about the book and so forth, and somebody MCs the program. I had the honor of being involved in it for many years.
Oh,
and
that sounds great.
Yeah, it's really terrific, and gets the word out for what you're doing and so forth.
Yeah, that would be great.
Now, when does the book come out?
My book came out on Tuesday. So
oh, beautiful.
Right,
good timing. Good timing, kiddo.
Yeah.
Good timing. Well, as I said, it's been a pleasure chatting with you, the collector of dying breaths. And for myself and all your fans, I thank you for sharing a little time and your unique talents with all of us. If people like to get some information on your website, MJ?
Yes, it's very easy. It's MJ Rose.
Terrific. Well, we'll look forward to the next one, and keep us on the radar. I'm sure Deb will do that.
Yes.
But if there's anything we can do to get the word out, please let us know.
Oh, you're doing it. I really appreciate it. You're just wonderful to talk to.
My pleasure. Thanks, kiddo.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Talk to you. MJ Rose, a great, exciting thriller called The Collector of Dying Breaths. I really enjoyed it. And she has a couple other ones, The Book of Lost Fragrances and Seduction. But the book just came out. And if you're out and about, take a look at it. You'll very much enjoy it. Very exciting. Edge of your seat. But historical fiction, too, because it gives some very interesting and factual information that, especially around about the Renaissance, Catherine de' Medici, who was one of the queens of France, and the history involving that time frame. So, again, MJ Rose, a delight to chat with her, the author of The Collector of Dying Breaths. The mission of Misericordia Heart of Mercy is to support individuals with developmental disabilities in maximizing their level of independence and self-determination within an environment that fosters spirituality, dignity, respect, and enhancement of quality of life. We promote development of natural family and community support, community awareness, education, and advocacy. Candy Days are here again, and we need your support. Join legions of loyal volunteers on Friday and Saturday, April 25th and 26th, for Misericordia's 29th annual Candy Days Drive. Loyal supporters numbering in the thousands will once again slip into their signature red and white aprons at train stations, street corners, and shopping areas across Chicagoland and the suburbs. Misericordia is home to more than 600 children and adults with developmental disabilities. 100% of the proceeds from Candy Days fund programs crucial for Misericordia's infants, children, and adults with mental disabilities, many also physically impaired. Misericordia's wide range of quality programs includes residential, social, therapeutic, and vocational opportunities. And on the line with us right now is the executive director of Misericordia Heart of Mercy, one of Chicago's most beloved people, and certainly one of our family's dearest friends. Looking forward to the 29th annual Misericordia Candy Days, Friday, April 25th, and Saturday, April 26th, all throughout Chicago and the suburbs. Our good friend, Sister Rosemary Conley. Sister, welcome back to the Kevin Moore Show.
Well, thank you, Kevin, and thank you for your kind words. They're very important to us.
It's always a pleasure. Now, this is 29 years. You were still in grammar school when we started this.
Oh, probably. You're pushing it a bit, but that's all right, Kevin.
You know, it's going to be a great day. It's always a great day. Rain or shine, everybody's out there. And I always go to, you know, with the Walshes on Adams and Halston and Greektown. There we have a ball. But everybody has fun doing this, Sister Rosemary.
Well, they do. You know, it's such a public witness. The money is so important. And please, God, will continue to raise over $1 million with the 2 days people out on the street. But the public witness that so many people will be willing to stand out there, people not used to begging, holding a can, asking them to support one of their favorite charities. So we're so blessed, Kevin. And, you know, the public witness is almost as important as the money. But we do need the money because we operate with such a deficit. You know.
And it's interesting, too, Sister, so people don't even know about Misericordia, but for people standing on the corners or wherever they're at, train stations, so forth, that's a way to introduce Misericordia to people who have, heretofore haven't had any kind of information about Misericordia.
You know, that is so true. We think we're well known, but it's still surprising how many people say, what's Misericordia? You know, and the best tool to tell our story is to have people come for a tour. And once you've walked around and you meet our children and adults and you meet, we have almost 1,000 staff, you meet, and they're all so competent and compassionate and loving. And you see all the volunteers, you know, people leave really grateful that they took the time to take a tour because of the fact that they were almost afraid to come knowing that it was children and adults with disabilities. Mm. And, you know, we're needed because suffering is a reality. No one wants a child to be born or to become mentally or physically disabled, but it happens. And these children and adults teach us such beautiful lessons about living life on God's terms. And it's a happy place, and people don't expect it to be happy. And we are surrounded with some of the most beautiful people you could find in the world, Kevin.
You never see anybody without a smile at Misericordia.
Well, usually you don't. Maybe someone came in a bad day once in a while. But always there is a spirit of peace and joy and happiness. And most of the residents, you know, 20% of our population have no families, mm-hmm. or are extreme poverty families. Mm-hmm. But most of them come from middle-class families that love them, and they come to Misericordia, and that love is continued, and the challenge is always good for them, and it's a happy place, Kevin, and that's important.
How long have you been at Misericordia, Sister?
Oh, just a few years, Kevin. I've been here 45 years.
Oh, God bless you. And you've met so many people, and you're such a great leader. People want to be part of it because of you and all the great people that are involved.
Well, mostly because of the children and adults. But thank God I've had this opportunity. It's been a wonderful journey. I've walked it with some of the best people in the whole world, and I feel so privileged to be able to continue to play a role in it.
I think that's what we need to do, is get the word out for people to come by and visit. And one way of doing that, as you know, Sister, is to maybe come over for lunch or come over for Sunday brunch and enjoy the dining room and the facilities there to have a little breakfast with their families.
Oh, thank you for that ad, Kevin, because we love people coming to our greenhouse inn, and that's open Tuesdays through Friday from 9:30 to 2:30. Then on Sundays it's open from 9:30 until 2:30. During the week from Tuesday to Friday, it opens around 11 and it goes on until about 2:30 or 3. On Sundays, it opens at 9:30, and it's not only brunch, it's also breakfast. And it's open until about 2:30.
And people can come by and they can go to the shops and buy some of the things that are made by the kids at Misericordia and the adults, young adults and so forth. They can bakery. The bakery is always terrific. And now that the schools and the universities are finishing up, it's a great way to send a care package to your sons and daughters.
Oh, thank you, Kevin. Those are such good ideas, and they're important because our bakery provides packaging, provides opportunities for jobs for our adults, and jobs are not easy to come by. We have some that go out to places and work, but it's usually about 2 or 3 hours a day, 2 or 3 days a week. So we have to create so many job opportunities right here on campus, and the ones that live out in Silla's come back and spend time with us, as well as the ones that live on campus. And they're all, everyone has a reason to get up in the morning. And that's important.
You know, we had a delightful time at my brother-in-law's wedding, Scully's wedding we had in the new building. That we had a great reception there. We had a wonderful time. And what a great facility that is, Sister Rosemary.
Oh, that is beautiful, you know. And we were so happy that we could share that very special moment with the Scully family. Because, Kevin, you and they have been such good friends. And it goes back many generations that they have been involved with us. And it's so nice to have, you know, your family so involved, and we're blessed indeed.
And that's what's kind of special, Sister Rosemary, is generations now pass that legacy down where younger people are getting involved, where the grandfathers and grandmothers and great-grandfathers and grandmothers are involved. Now the young people are involved also.
And it's wonderful. And everyone, you know, needs to reach out beyond their own world. And thank God so many have found their way to Misericordia. And, you know, they give so generously, and they would be the first to say they get back a hundredfold because of their involvement. So a shared ministry is an important part of our mission, and so many people really feel part of Misericordia because they do share our ministry.
This year, Misericordia must raise $13 million for program costs not covered by the government. In addition, Misericordia raises funds for construction projects in order to welcome some of the 500 individuals on its waiting list. Founded in 1921, Misericordia, which means Heart of Mercy in Latin, is a community of care for more than 600 children and adults with mild to profound developmental disabilities from diverse religious, racial, and socioeconomic backgrounds. Misericordia's programs include residential placement and day-to-day support, employment opportunities, physical and speech therapy, social and recreational outings, health and fitness activities, and opportunities for spiritual growth. And on the line with us right now is the executive director of Misericordia Heart of Mercy, our very dear friend, Sister Rosemary Connolly. The 29th annual Misericordia Candy Days, Friday and Saturday, April 25th and 26th, from sunrise to sunset throughout Chicago and the suburbs. We're all looking forward to it, Sister. I know you're going to be out and about and having a good time. And we have to remember to thank Jelly Belly, too, for all they do for us.
Oh, thank you, Kevin. That is such a good. They have done this for several years, and it's a $100,000 donation that they make through supplying all the Jelly Bellies for us. And Mr. Kelly is one of the main people who's involved in this, and it's such a gift.
Well, God bless you, Sister, and thank you always for taking a little time. You know, it's delightful to chat with you about anything that's going on at Misericordia, and anything we can do, you know we're always there for you.
Thank you, Kevin. I know that, and it is such a gift. God bless you and yours.
Thank you, Sister.
Bye now.
Have a good day. Sister Rosemary Connolly, what a delightful, delightful lady. She's such a beloved lady, and she's a gem here and a treasure we have in the city of Chicago, and we thank her for all that she does. But if you can, the best way to thank her is participate in the 29th annual Misericordia Candy Days, Friday, April 25th and Saturday, April 26th, all throughout Chicago and the suburbs. Rain or shine, we'll be out there, and mostly it's been raining lately, but it's still a lot of fun, and when you see all of us in those cover-ups and so forth, remember it's for a wonderful cause, Misericordia, Heart of Mercy. And for information, I want to add, please call 773-273-2766. Experience the music of Andrew Lloyd Webber with Score by Score at Metropolis. Enjoy a rare behind-the-scenes glimpse at the inspiration for some of Broadway's greatest hits with Kevin Moore Presents Score by Score, an evening of Andrew Lloyd Webber at the Metropolis Performing Arts Center, Wednesday, April 24th. Join yours truly in a celebration of Andrew Lloyd Webber and his amazing music. We'll try to entertain you as to what inspired Webber, what was going on when he wrote Evita, Cats, The Phantom of the Opera, Jesus Christ Superstar, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, and more. As you learn the history, sit back and enjoy some of Chicago's top cabaret artists, including Ken Baker, Jen Shada, music director George Howe, Laura Freeman, Heather Moran, and our program director, the great Daryl Nitz, performing the memorable songs from these extraordinary shows. Kevin Moore Presents Score by Score, an evening of Andrew Lloyd Webber, comes to Metropolis April 24th at 7:30. And on the line with us right now is the award-winning stage personality, master showman, impressionist, nationally recognized vocalist, director, producer, teacher, mentor, one of the driving forces in the cabaret scene in Chicago, former president of the Chicago Cabaret Professionals, and now presenting Score by Score, the best of Broadway musicals, the music of the night, an evening of Andrew Lloyd Webber, Thursday, April 24th at 7:30, the Metropolis Performing Arts Center, 111 West Campbell Street in downtown Arlington Heights. Our good pal, Mr. Daryl Nitz. What do you say, buddy?
How are you?
Always a pleasure, and we're looking forward to this, huh? Andrew Lloyd Webber is back, and it's back with a lot of enthusiasm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know the tickets are selling really well, and so if people want to get their seats, they should do it soon. There's really 2 weeks from today, as a matter of fact, that the show will take place. So I think there's maybe about 50 seats left. And, that's great.
People love Andrew Lloyd Webber. He's the contemporary composer of some of the great and classic, or soon to be classic, or will be classic musicals, of course, as I mentioned, Phantom and Jesus Christ Superstar, Joseph and so forth.
Yeah.
A lot of great music, and some people think it's an acquired taste, but you can't argue with the success, Daryl.
No, you can't. You know, I used to work in a club called the Big House, and they actually had a sign that was like the red don't sign. It was, and it said like Andrew Lloyd Webber, and it was in a big red circle, and then an X through it. And basically, they want to know Andrew Lloyd Webber sung at their club. And I think it is kind of a, I don't know if it's necessarily an acquired taste, but there's people who love Andrew Lloyd Webber, and there's people who really despise him. You know, initially when you first brought this project to me, I balked at it and thought, you know, it's one of my least favorite composers. But after putting this together and then having performed this show, there is really no music like this that has the quality of I mean, people think of Phantom of the Opera, so it's like opera. But, I mean, this quality, an opera-like quality or a Puccini-like quality is present in even things from Cats or Song and Dance or Evita. There is... not just in Phantom of the Opera that you see the influence of opera on a composer. And you can't say that about Cole Porter or Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, Stephen Sondheim. So it's very unique music.
Well, I think the secret and the quality of this show is exactly that. You don't get the normal Andrew Lloyd Webber. You have done such a remarkable job in putting some of those songs that he's had in his musicals that might not have been as popular as The Phantom or Cats, but saw some of these love songs and put them together in such a way that people might not have heard them before, yet they leave the show and go, oh, that's beautiful. I got to get a little more information about that.
Yeah, like Whistle Down the Wind. I mean, the song Whistle Down the Wind is a beautiful song. It actually was a pop song, I think, by Tina Arena in London, and it had success there. But as far as here in America, I played in Washington, D.C., and then the show never really went, you know, anywhere else. And also Aspects of Love, although not always a popular musical as far as, you know, maybe reviews and things like that, people said. But there are some really great songs from that show that, again, make the London pop, you know, charts. You know, it's kind of interesting. I see now, you know, like these songs from that movie Frozen on our pop charts.
Right.
There hasn't been that kind of a effect in America, but in London, when a show is popular, a song from Matilda, a song from an Andrew Lloyd Webber musical will appear on their pop charts,
right,
or their pop artists will cover songs from musicals like we used to do in the 70s. You know what I mean?
Sure, so sure.
That's what this has. It has a lot of the familiarity of tunes that in Great Britain would have been on the radio. We know them from these musicals, and things like Evita and Phantom are done all the time. Joseph's done quite regularly. Joseph's being done somewhere right now.
And I think that's what we do with Kevin Moore Presents Score by Score. We introduce people to great music, but we reintroduce people to the music that they've known in the past, like Rodgers and Hammerstein and Gershwin and Cole Porter some of the great composers of all time and of the Great American Songbook, and people enjoy that, and they're going to leave the show and go, boy, this is kind of interesting. I'd like to know more about it. I'd like to re-listen to that music, and I'd like to continue to do so. So I think that's the interesting part of it.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And we're doing something from Love Never Dies as well, which is the sequel to Phantom. We're just doing one number from that, but I think it's a appropriate way to, you know, doing music that spans from 1968 with Joseph all the way to 2010 with Love Never Dies.
A little surprise at the end, if people look forward to that.
Yeah.
And certainly another surprise coming up here in short order on Sunday, May 4th at 7 o'clock at Davenport's. And I'm going to embarrass you a little bit, but Bright Lights Big City, your first solo show in over 10 years, a kind of a 90-minute tour de force retrospective of your 25-year career in the Chicago nightclubs and concert venues, some of the great places you've performed like Preston Bradley Hall, Maxim's, the Park West, Drury Lane Water Tower, the Roman Coliseum, all these great places you've been. And it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I wore my toga. Well, you know, I've had a very, very awesome. My year has been really great, or I should say, you know, in cabaret, in music, it's kind of like a theater season where you start in September and you kind of wind down for summer. Although I will be performing throughout the whole summer, at Davenport's. But in October, getting honored by CCP with the Gold Coast Award, I did a 20-minute clip of mostly songs that I have never sung before, and it was an homage to Chicago and the performers here in Chicago who have influenced me and encouraged me through the years. I mean, you talk how I do that for other people. Well, I do that because people did that for me, like Pudgy and Buddy Charles and Audrey Morris and Esther Hanna and Nan Mason, and these people encouraged me. So I like to do that with talent as well. And so I took this idea of this 20 minutes where people said, you know, I never heard you sing that. When did you do that? I said, no, this is almost all new material. There's nothing old in what I did. And I expanded on it, and then I turned 50 in December and did a birthday show and did a couple new songs in there. So I'm bringing Here's to Life into the show as well. And I'm telling the story of, in 90 minutes, of my singing in Chicago, but going a little bit earlier, like when I was 15, 16, singing in the church.
Mm-hmm.
So I start with, I was talking to my dad, you know, I think I'm one of the only people in cabaret who's directed a gospel cabaret called Stop by the Church, but has also directed a show called Explicit Lyrics. And so it runs the gamut. You know, I said to my dad, I said, I'm doing a song called Moses, and I'm doing a song called Up Above My Head, I Hear Music in the Air. I said, but I'm also singing some songs like Don't Come Too Soon. And, well, the other titles, I don't know if I can say.
You better not, yeah.
but they're a little racy. And, you know, they're songs from the 30s and 40s that don't get much airplay. But they're those obscure songs. You know, my dad's like, only you would put those types of things. But that's what I'm trying to show. And we're also doing contemporary songs like, I'm having Carol Channing sing Royals. I don't know. Do you listen to the, you know, the song Royals?
Well, I don't, but, you know, that's another thing to bring up. You're a great impressionist, too, and I mentioned that a little bit in the introduction with some of the impressions you do with Billie Holiday and Carol Channing and Tallulah Bankhead and Bobby Short and so forth. That's kind of interesting. And sing those songs in those kinds of ways.
Yeah, that's what. So Carol Channing is doing Royals, so she's like, I never seen a diamond in the flesh. I cut my teeth on wedding rings in the movies. You know, I'm doing Billie Holiday singing Both Sides Now. And, you know, kind of, I like to always say to myself, what if, you know,
sure,
what if Carol Channing at 90
sure
had a pop song and was doing this or whatever.
Well, but she's still around, isn't she?
Yeah, she is. Yeah. She's like 91, I think.
God love her. God love her. Yeah. And of course, you're there on at Davenport's on Friday nights and Saturday nights with George.
Now we're just on Saturdays.
Saturdays, okay.
Mary Ann Murphy's on Fridays, and we're approaching in October. It'll be 1,000 shows, 15 years.
Wow, that's remarkable. That's remarkable.
Time goes by, my friend.
It really does. Score by Score, the Best of Broadway Musicals, is an entertainment production company that offers cabaret-style musical concerts featuring some of Chicago's most talented and recognized names in the art of cabaret. Score by Score Productions reintroduce and revitalize audiences to the timeless American classic musical by celebrating the great American songbook and music from the Great White Way. They are unique, sophisticated, well-sung, and acted musical theater experiences, replete with inventive direction and design that stimulates an audience's imagination, creativity, and intellect. Using voice and piano, each concert is presented in an intimate manner that is personally communicated and connected. And then April 24th at the Metropolis Performing Arts Center, 7:30, Kevin Moore presents Score by Score, an evening of Andrew Lloyd Webber, the music of the night. And don't forget, on Sunday, May 4th at 7 o'clock, Daryl Nitz, the great, returns to the back room of Davenport's with his first solo show in over 10 years. Bright Lights, Big City is a 90-minute tour de force retrospective of his 25-year career in the Chicago nightclubs and concert venues. You've got a busy couple weeks here, buddy.
I certainly do, and I'm looking forward to both of them.
It should be a lot of fun. How about if people would like to get some information? I know at the Metropolis you can call 847-577-2121. And what about Davenport's?
Yeah, Davenport's is 773-278-1830.
Beautiful.
And you can make reservations, or you can go to their website, too, and make reservations for any of their shows. But you can also do it by calling.
And do it quickly, because they're both going to be sold out.
I have a feeling. I know that they told me that my show's selling well, but it's not at the capacity that the Webber is. I mean, the Webber's probably got 50 seats left. So.
Well, let's keep in mind that if, in fact, Davenport's does sell out, we still do have the Roman Coliseum. My friend, always a pleasure to chat with you. Always a pleasure to chat with you. Yeah, have a good day, and we'll see you soon.
All right, bye-bye.
Thank you, my pal. The great Daryl Nitz, of course, in two very special shows, again, experience the music of Andrew Lloyd Webber, the music of the night. Kevin Moore presents Score by Score at Metropolis Performing Arts Center, located in beautiful downtown Arlington Heights, on Thursday, April 24th at 7:30. For information, 847-577-2121. And don't forget to give the opportunity to get to Daryl's show at the Davenport's Piano Bar. And that's on Sunday, May 4th. First solo show in 10 years. Kind of remarkable. Bright Lights, Big City. It'll be a great evening. And go on Davenport's website to get that information. Always a pleasure to chat with, as I always call him, the great Daryl Nitz. Well, that about does it for our show today. I thank you for sharing this last hour with me and hope you, our listeners, have enjoyed this time as much as I have. Especially like to thank M.J. Rose, the author of The Collector of Dying Breaths. Interesting novel. Please take advantage and get it if you can at your local bookstore or log on to M.J.'s website, www.mjrose.com. Our very dear friend, Sister Rosemary Conley, celebrating the 29th annual Misericordia Candy Days, Friday, April 25th and Saturday, April 26th, all throughout Chicago and suburbs. For information, 773-273-2766. Always a delight to chat with Sister Rosemary, the Executive Director of Misericordia, Heart of Mercy. And finally, our good pal, the great Daryl Nitz. Kevin Moore presents Score by Score, the best of Broadway musicals, The Music of the Night, an evening of Andrew Lloyd Webber, Thursday, April 24th at 7:30 at the Metropolis Performing Arts Center, 111 West Campbell Street in downtown Arlington Heights. For information, 847-577-2121. And his special show, Bright Lights, Big City at Davenport's. Go onto their website and get that information because it'll be a wonderful evening. Finally, a famous writer once said, one ought, every day at least, to hear a little song, read a good poem, see a fine picture, and if it were possible, to speak a few reasonable words. I hope on our show today we have, at the very least, done just that, spoken a few reasonable words. At that, I'd like to wish everyone a good week. And as that British group once said, and in the end, the love that you take is equal to the love that you make. Have a happy Easter.
yet be the best of friends. If we can try with every day to make it better as it grows, any luck then I suppose. The music, the music.